just say it makes my own betrothal seem slightly less outrageous. Kira shook her head. I don't think I'll ever get married, she said. I don't think I want to put Donald through what Taze is clearly willing to endure for you. Most of our days, it is just the two of us, and we're mystics. We're equals, and we're content. When circumstances compel me to play the Saramara, he likes to step back. He likes to play the servant or the guard. Some people know of our relationship, but only those we trust, and Donald would not be happy to think the great lords and ladies were whispering about me and how far I'd fallen. I can't see a day in the near future when that will change. I can't see the day he'd ever ask my father for my hand. Senith looked at her. But that doesn't mean he loves you any less. Kira shook her head. Or that I love him any less. She gave Senith a small smile. I think I own him, Senith. I think there is nothing I could do to drive him away. That moves me and frightens me and makes me want to be very, very careful with his heart. So I will not put it on display in the drawing rooms of the 12 houses. Senith nodded. She was watching Taze excuse himself from his conversation with Cammon and the steward's daughter and make his way toward her. He looked too big for the room, too powerful for these pretty, delicate tables and graceful, thin-legged chairs. If he put a foot wrong or turned too quickly, he could accidentally break something. Oh, but Taze was too graceful for that. He moved through the room as lightly as a shadow, touching nothing. He saw her, noticing him, and he rewarded her with a smile. Whereas I will drag Taze to any house and any battlefield I happen to find, Senith said quietly. If I have to endure it, then by the bright mother's red eye, so should he. But he never complains. Why would he complain? Kira scoffed. That man would do anything you asked. He'd die for you. Senith watched him come closer, and her own smile grew. She said, He'd better not. 2 days later, a party of 5 set out for Gosenhall. They left Will behind to spend some time getting to know his affianced bride and touring the extensive grounds of Danilustris. The Brazenthwaite guards were also left behind, though Will offered to send at least some of them along to protect the travelers. Will, 4 mystics and a rider hardly need anyone's protection, Senith told him with some amusement. He smiled and patted her hair, which was in its usual flyaway state. Just a gesture of affection, he said. I would sacrifice my own security on the return trip to Brazenthwaite to keep you safe. She hugged him. I'm safe, she said. Congratulations on your betrothal. Congratulations on your own as well. She was glad enough to be leaving Danilustris, heading back toward the royal city. Between one unexpected trip or another, she had been gone far longer than she had planned. She didn't mind it for her own sake. She could never bear to sit still in any one place for long. But she knew Baron had hoped she would be back sooner. She also felt a little guilty about keeping Cammon away from his studies for such an extended time. You'll have forgotten everything Gerald ever taught you, she said. It was late afternoon, on their second day out of Dannon Hall, and they were heading southeast through the upper tip of Storian lands. Taze was about 100 yards in the lead. Kira and Donald were behind them on the path, talking quietly. By the time we get back to Gosenhall, you won't be able to read minds at all. I can't read minds, he said automatically. Ha! Tell me how I'm feeling about my brother agreeing to marry Kasara Danilustris. He smiled. You're pleased, but anyone could tell that. I saw you talking to my Lord Malcolm the night before we left, she said. Was he trying to hire you? He seemed very interested in discovering just what you're capable of. He was testing me, Cammon said. Kira had told him I can tell when someone is lying, so he would say something to me and I was supposed to guess whether or not he was telling the truth. He's a very hard man to read. Malcolm? Seneth said derisively. Indeed he is. Impenetrable, in fact. Even his own daughters would tell you they never know what he's thinking. How often were you able to separate the truth from the lie? Kamen looked surprised. Every time. She started laughing. Oh, very impressive. How much did he offer you to stay? Kamen grinned. He told me I could name my price. You should have said, let me marry Kasara. That would have been interesting. But I don't want to marry her. No, the point would be... Never mind. I can't believe he let you ride out. Kamen looked a little self-conscious. I may have told him I'd come back. Oh, we'll see you wearing Denilustrous Red before another year is gone. Kira and Donal trotted up. Is my father trying to recruit Kamen? Kira asked. I knew he would. Kasara liked him, too. Too bad my father has run out of daughters to marry off, or he'd try to bind you into the family. Seneth glanced at her. Don't you have cousins somewhere, or some nice young girl born to a high-ranking vassal? Not everyone wants to marry a fortune, but every man appreciates a good plot of land, Donal put in. Malcolm's ruthless enough to dispossess a lordling if he thought Kamen might value the estate. Seneth and Kira laughed, but Kamen didn't seem to think it was funny. I don't want to be a landowner, he exclaimed. What would I do with property? Settle down, become rich, acquire a little sophistication, Kira suggested. I don't know how we'd ever get your hair to behave, but maybe a nice velvet suit, some expensive boots, we could polish you up a lot. I don't think so, Kamen said. Face it, Kira, of the six of us, you're the only one who's ever going to look remotely respectable, Seneth said. You can dress us up, you can sit us at the Marlord's table, but we're all going to look like peasants, soldiers, and vagabonds. Well, if you'd put a little effort into it, Kira said. Donald's voice held a grin. Not all the effort in the world would serve to transform some of us. Kamen opened his mouth to speak, but instead a guttural sound came out, as if he'd been punched in the stomach. Seneth glanced over and saw him suddenly jerk upright and then put a hand over his heart with a cry of pain. She pulled hard on her reins, reaching across to him, but he was already slumping in the saddle. His horse whinnied and came to an uncertain stop. Kira and Donal almost rode over him. Kamen, what? Seneth began, but then he cried out again and tumbled off his horse onto the hard ground. Taze! Seneth screamed, pulling her sword and looking wildly around for any sign of attackers. Behind her, she felt rather than saw Donal shift shape and take wing, soaring upward to reconnoiter. Kira had scrambled out of her own saddle and was already on the ground beside Kamen as Taze came thundering up.
What happened? Did he faint? Was he hurt?
The rider demanded. His own sword was out, and he was raking the vistas ahead and behind for any evidence of trouble. They were passing through fairly open land. It was hard to believe they could have been ambushed by an enemy still out of sight. Sen, Kira called, looking up from Kamen's prone body. There's not a wound on him. His pulse is fast and his skin's cold, but he's untouched, physically. Seneth glanced at Taze and he nodded, so she slid down from her horse and crouched beside Kira in the dirt. Then what happened to him? What's wrong? Kira's hands were pressed to Kamen's chest, willing some of her own strength into him. Kira possessed both healing power and some training as a nurse. Seneth's own fiery magic could be bent toward rough-and-ready physicking, though she didn't pretend to have Kira's finesse. Still, both of them needed a wound they could see or a disease they could understand. It looked like Kamen had been felled by something more mysterious. Seneth laid her hands on his forehead, and it felt cool and clammy against her palms. Kam, she said, her voice hard, pitched to break through a cloudy mind. Kamen, where are you? What happened to you? He opened his eyes, and they seemed pale with pain. For a moment he labored to catch his breath. His lips moved, and Seneth bent down to hear whatever word he was struggling to form. He whispered, "Justin."
Audible Frontiers presents Dark Moon Defender. Written by Sharon Shin and read by Joe Barrett.
Chapter 28. Eleanor sat at the infirmary window and watched the rain sluice down. It was a cold, nasty precipitation, laced with ice and driven by a hard wind, and literally no one had stepped into the courtyard all morning to brave it. She wondered for the 100th time if Justin and his companion had left at some point when she had turned away from the window, or if they were still sitting in the barracks, waiting out the worst of the weather. It was past noon now. If they didn't leave soon, they wouldn't have enough daylight left to make it back to Neft. And if he spent another night at the convent... "Eleanor?" The voice from the bed was Rosary's, and Eleanor left her post at the window to answer her. "Do you think I could try to stand up now? I feel so much stronger, and I drank all my milk this morning." "Let's see," Eleanor said, pulling back the covers and taking Rosary's arm. The Black Mother knew Eleanor would rejoice for a whole host of reasons if Rosary made a fast recovery. "I think you're still a little weak, but let's see you walk across the room a few times." Rosary managed the feat slowly, dipping now and then from dizziness, but negotiating the room three times before dropping back into her bed. "I feel so stiff, like all my muscles have been shredded," she said. "Well, you should have seen yourself, your whole body clenched tight for days. I'd think you'd be terribly sore after that." Rosary passed a hand over her bare scalp, where the little nicks were healed over but still visible. "It feels so strange not to have hair," she remarked, "like my head weighs almost nothing." Eleanor poured another glass of milk and handed it over. "Are you sorry you cut it?" "Oh, no. The Silver Lady smiled at me when I took the razor in my hand. She knew what a great sacrifice I was making, and it pleased her. Besides, now I carry no Lyran markings at all, nothing to show I belong anywhere but here." Eleanor watched her swallow the milk. "Drink up, grow strong. When you are well enough, I am leaving." "It is good to find the place you feel you are supposed to be," she said quietly. Though Eleanor had no idea where that place would be for her. "Do you think I might go down to dinner tonight?" "Probably not," Eleanor said. "But I'll have someone bring you a plate of food, and if you eat it all, you can go down for breakfast tomorrow." "I'm still a little tired," Rosary admitted, "but I'm so bored just lying here." Eleanor smiled. "That usually means you're well on the way to getting better." They talked sporadically after that, and Eleanor checked on the other three patients, all of them with that hacking cough Deanna had developed, though none of them as ill as the proselyte had been. When everyone was fed, medicated, cleaned up, and resting again, Eleanor went back to the window. The rain had abated. The sullen clouds looked as if they might grudgingly give way to a little weak sunlight. Eleanor could feel the cold seeping in past the window glass, but that didn't bother her, and it shouldn't stop a determined traveler. The roads would be wet, but not impassable, not if you were willing to take your time and didn't mind kicking up a little mud on the road. Evidently, she was not the only one to reach that conclusion. While she watched, a small caravan plodded into her line of sight, moving from the back of the convent and slowly across the courtyard. Two men and six horses. Justin and the freighter. They paused briefly at the gate, waiting until it was unlatched and swung back, and then urged their animals forward into the wet, cold depths of the forest. Just as he passed through the gate, Justin turned his head and glanced back, his eyes searching the convent windows, looking, Eleanor knew, for any glimpse of her. She stayed where she was, far enough back from the glass that he probably could not see her. In a moment, he faced forward again and urged his horse onward. She was standing by the window again about 30 minutes later, feeling bereft and depressed, when she saw a second party of men go riding through the gates. There were 5 of them, all convent guards, and by the glitter of metal in the frail sunlight she could see they were heavily armed. There were too many to be running simple errands, not enough to be planning a midnight raid on some hapless mystic's house. A hunting party? Maybe. But hunting game? Or hunting men? For the 100th time, Eleanor asked herself, did Dakin see Justin last night? Had he guessed the visitor had spent the evening wooing a convent novice? Dakin was not among the men riding out through the gates, but that didn't mean much. Astira had reported he wasn't very good with a weapon. He spends so much time practicing. He says he's getting better, but I can tell he's disappointed. If the convent guards had decided to ride out to punish a man who had dared to romance a novice, they would send seasoned men to do the task, warriors, true swordsmen. Oh, great mother, if they were truly going after Justin. Eleanor glanced at all her charges, either sleeping or peacefully lying in bed reading. Darris would be here within the hour to relieve her. No one would die if the infirmary was unattended that long. Eleanor could not sit there, could not feel this great restless terror clawing through her blood. She had to go. She had to find out. She had to see if the soldiers had set out with the intention of harming Justin. She slipped out of the infirmary, down the hall, down the stairs, through the great reception hall with its echoing spaces and massive chandeliers, out into the courtyard, where the dampness of the air made the cold that much sharper. Eleanor shivered, and for a moment considered going back inside for her cloak, even for some food, in case she was gone for several hours. But there was no time. She didn't mind the chill, and she would set a brisk enough pace that her blood would heat up. And surely she would not be gone long enough to miss more than a meal or two. Surely nothing had really happened to Justin. There were 2 soldiers guarding the entrance and 3 walking the perimeter, engaged in idle conversation. None of them saw her. It was trickier to pass the gate without being noticed, since she had to pull it open just far enough to slip through. She waited till the pair at the entrance got distracted by the arrival of 2 relief guards, and then she made her escape. The metal did not squeal. It barely moved as she made it gape just wide enough for her to squeeze out. Then she was on the path, striding through the forest at an uncomfortably fast pace. Drops of frigid water dripped on her from the overhanging branches. Now and then a squirrel ran overhead and shook a small storm of icy rain onto her head. Within 20 yards, the hems of her white robes were wet and filthy, and her feet were already caked with mud. Fortunately, her shoes were good, comfortable and sturdy. She could walk all day in these. All day and all night, if she had to. She was not much of a tracker, not like Torin was, but even she could tell that everyone who had left the convent this day had gone in the same direction. There were multiple sets of hoofprints in the mud. The road had been fairly churned up by the passage of 10 or so animals. Bad news for anyone coming behind them on foot who was interested in keeping clean. Good news for anyone trying to follow their trail. She couldn't judge, as Torin would have been able to, how quickly the later party was gaining on the travelers who had left the convent first, but common sense told her the soldiers had moved faster. They had better horses, none of them tied to a lead. they had a stronger purpose. Maybe not. Maybe the soldiers were just riding into town, delivering messages for the Lestra, picking up supplies that could not be trusted to strangers. Maybe Eleanor was afraid, and cold and hungry, for no good reason at all. She had been on the trail about 2 hours, when daylight started to fail. She wasn't afraid of the dark, not in the least, but the onset of night would force her to make a quick decision. Keep going forward, giving up any chance of returning to the convent with some story about why she had left so abruptly, or go back. Walk on toward Neft, with no cloak, no provisions, and no hope of arriving in the city before morning, or turn back now. She kept walking. Another mile down the road, she saw them. At first, she didn't realize what they were, the dark shapes lying so still across the path. Fallen trees, or at least great, unwieldy branches flung down by the earlier storm. There were half a dozen, scattered right on this bend of the road, tossed down from some tree so big and so old that it could not withstand the force of a winter storm. 10 steps closer, and she realized they were not tree limbs. They were bodies. 7 bodies strewn across the road. 5 in the black and silver livery of the convent, 2 in nondescript traveling gear. All of them covered with blood. One of them was Justin. She screamed, and the forest around her echoed with startled cries. But she didn't care. She didn't hear. She ran forward, sobbing, her breath fogging around her face, her hands the temperature of ice. "Great Mother, Sweet Mother, Dark Mother, please let him not be dead." She knelt beside him, her hands on his chest before her knees had even settled into the mud. She could feel the blood, slick and damp, on his clothes. But she didn't care about that. She had to check for body temperature, for heartbeat, for the subtle lift and settle of breath. Her seeking fingers found rents in his clothing, great gashes in the flesh beneath. She tilted her head so that her ear was just over his mouth. An exhalation, faint and warm. A pulse, buried and weak. Sweet, kind, holy mother, Justin was alive. Eleanor flattened both of her hands against his chest, nesting her fingers in the ripped and bloody fabric of his shirt. Her own breath slowed. Her concentration became fierce and total. "Great Mother," she prayed, her lips moving, but the words silent. "Fill me with your power. Make my hands your hands, my blood, your magic. Heal this man. Save him. Great Mother, I love him. Save him for me." She felt warmth trickle through her as a perceptible heat built up between her shoulder blades and slowly spread through all her bones and muscles. But there was an icy band around her left wrist, the place where the baleful moonstones on her bracelet lay against her skin. The Pale Mother's gems. The Silver Lady hated mystics. Impatiently, Eleanor paused to undo the fine catch of the slim silver chain. She tossed the bracelet into the forest, as far from the deadfall as she could. Instantly, she felt the heat in her blood leap higher. Her hands were almost on fire. Her fingertips were conduits of flame. Justin's torso jerked slightly, as if shocked by a burning brand, and then he lay still. She felt the fever run from her body into his. She almost saw the magic arc from her closed system into his opened veins. The power pooled around her, like heavy rain on over-soaked soil, then drained slowly into Justin's chest, pooled again, and again was absorbed. Again. Again. He was so close to death that nothing, not even the mother's energy, could sustain him for long. He was so empty of life that he could be filled and refilled and never overflow. "Justin," Eleanor whispered, "Justin, breathe. Force your heart to beat. Live." And still the great mother's dense magic poured into her, unstinting, bottomless. Eleanor felt herself growing heavy, rich, saturated with darkness. If Justin opened his eyes, if a stranger chanced upon her on this road, they would see her face black as midnight, tears as bright as stars upon her cheeks. Her hands would look like shadows. She would appear to be nothing but a layered shape, indistinguishable from the night itself. Justin breathed. His heart beat. He did not die. Keeping her hands pressed against his chest, Eleanor watched his face. Pale unto death, of course, marked with bruises and blood. The dark blonde hair had fallen back from his forehead and was matted with mud. Every bone and angle was exposed. He was unconscious. There could be no thought process to pull his features into any kind of recognizable expression. But she could see every pinch and flutter of his mouth and eyelids, could read the intensity along his clenched jaw. He was struggling, straining, as if to speak, as if to sit up, as if to wake. He was fighting. With every instinct of his body, against overwhelming odds, he was battling to survive. "Justin," she whispered, her lips against his, her voice whispering his name into his own mouth in case he had forgotten it. "Don't give up. Keep fighting. I love you. Do not surrender now." Beneath her lips, his mouth took in air. Beneath her hands, his heart kept beating. This was a man who did not want to die. She must do something about his wounds. The bleeding had slowed, but had not entirely stopped. Shifting her body so that one knee rested gently against his ribs, she wanted to make sure that she was touching him, always touching him, pouring her power into him in an unbroken stream. She began searching for something she could turn into a bandage. A fallen convent guard lay within reach. Eleanor hesitated only a moment, struggling with the reality of death, then closed her heart. She felt around for the clasp of his cloak and tugged it free of his body. It came away grudgingly, muddy and bloody and already torn in half, but it would do. Working as quickly as she could, never moving her knee from Justin's side, she ripped the cloak into smaller strips and pads and began binding the worst of Justin's wounds. That meant lifting him enough to pass the cloth under his body, an act that caused him to grunt with incoherent pain. But he seemed to lie easier once the bandages were in place. She convinced herself that the bleeding slowed and stopped. It was hard to tell. There was so much blood already. Not sure if it would help or hurt, she tried to tip a little water down Justin's throat. He swallowed, which she thought was a good sign, so she gave him a little more. She had no water skin of her own, no provisions at all, but Justin and the freighter had each carried water and some food. The convent soldiers as well, no doubt. Enough to keep a dying man alive for the rest of the night, the next day, the next night. But he could not lie there long enough to recover. He would almost certainly develop an infection from his wounds, and lying on the wet ground for a series of cold nights would send even a healthy man to his death. She needed blankets, clean bandages, medicinal herbs, broth, water, a bed, a fire. She needed to go for help. Neft was the nearest place, and from this point on the road it was probably 3 hours away on horseback. That made her look up. Where were the horses? She had been so preoccupied with the bodies on the ground that she had not even thought to check for living creatures in the vicinity. But there they were, bunched together a little distance down the road, mostly quiet now that the chaos of combat was past. She wondered why the fight had taken place on foot, and supposed the eager reach of forest branches had made it difficult to wield a sword from horseback. Or perhaps Justin had jumped from the saddle in the hope of racing off through the woods on trails a mounted man could not follow. In any case, it seemed that the horses had been abandoned in the heat of battle, and none of them had strayed yet. She counted 11 shadows, standing with their heads down and their tails limp. That presented a fresh worry. How quickly would the convent animals, left to their own devices, decide to wander back toward their familiar stables? That would be bad. That would surely signal someone at Luminon that trouble had felled the guards, which might not be news anyway, if the soldiers had been expected to return immediately upon dispatching the freighter's troublesome friend. If the guards did not return, or their horses returned without them, a search party would be on its way by dawn. Eleanor had to go to Neft for help, and bring the convent horses with her, or secure them here. She could make sure no one who traveled this road was able to find them. But how could she leave Justin? His hold on life was so tenuous that she was certain it was only her touch that kept his heart beating, his lungs functioning. He would die if she left him. He would die if she did not. "Great Mother, put your hands upon this man." She had been so absorbed in Justin that it had not occurred to her to wonder if anyone else had survived this day's confrontation. Experimentally, she pushed herself away from Justin's side, mere inches, close enough to touch him again if his breath faltered. But his chest rose and fell, a shallow but unmistakable movement. His lips tightened, as if against pain. She could risk the 10 minutes it would take to investigate the others. Quickly, she rose to her feet and shook out her ruined skirts. No need to check the guard whose cloak she had stolen. His head had been practically severed. He was definitely dead. She followed the bloody trail to the other 4 guards, kneeling beside each one and feeling for a pulse. Absent in every case. She tried not to look too closely, but it was impossible not to get some sense of how each one had died. 3 appeared to have received wounds straight to the heart. The other was so bloody she thought he too had been sliced across the jugular, after sustaining gashes on his face and hands and arms. A warrior. Just not quite good enough. The freighter was also dead, though there was no weapon in his hand or near his body. Not a fighter, not like the others. Had probably never in his life lifted a weapon to another man. Eleanor felt a fierce rush of bitter sadness at the life that had ended here so brutally, so pointlessly. This man had done nothing but try to earn a living, provide a service, carry out his commissions. He had died because Eleanor was foolish, because Eleanor loved a man she could not have. He had died because the Lestra was evil. That thought came from nowhere and filled her mind with a momentary blackness that had nothing to do with the Dark Watcher's presence. Hate and fear and fury flooded Eleanor's heart, and her hands clenched at her sides with her overwhelming desire to strike out. The Lestra was evil, the convent a source of violence and intimidation and despair. But not everyone inside its walls was vicious, was tainted. Not Deanna, not Astira, not Leah, not some of those laughing novices too young to understand the path they followed. The guards, some of them, like those here tonight, they were cruel and ruthless, but not all of them. Eleanor would not believe it of all of them. Hadn't that boy Kelty run away? Wasn't Dakin unhandy with a weapon? Surely there were some, new recruits, young boys fresh from their father's farms, who would be horrified to learn how their senior officers dealt in torture and death. And surely the pale mother herself was not so terrible. She was playful and vain and fickle and careless, but sometimes kind and always beautiful. and Eleanor could not bring herself to hate that charming, inconstant face. It was not the goddess who was to be hated and despised. It was the woman who had taken it upon herself to speak for the Silver Lady. It was the Lestra who burned mystics and sent her guards out hunting men. It was the Lestra who was responsible for tonight's deaths and near deaths. Eleanor hurried back to Justin, dropping beside him in the mud, still breathing, his skin still warm to the touch, no more blood seeping out past the makeshift bandages. Alive, alive, alive. For now. She bowed her head so low that her forehead almost touched Justin's. Some of her hair had escaped its habitual knot, and a few locks tumbled over her shoulder, coiling on Justin's chest. She had taken his hands in hers, and she squeezed his fingers just for the pleasure of feeling his living flesh against her skin. "Great Mother," she prayed. "Dark, beautiful lady, I am the daughter of the daughter of the hundreds of daughters of Mara. I call upon you now to redeem the promise you made to the women of the Lyrans. Give this man one night. Keep him alive one night. Hold him in your hands for one night. I must leave him, but I will return for him, and I beg you to keep him safe until that hour. Guard him with your body, strengthen him with your love, shield him with your darkness. Let no harm come to him. Let him live." Eleanor felt the night rustle and gather around her as the trees conferred and the clouds debated. The owls and the mice paused in their ceaseless game of chase and escape. Not far away, a wolf raised a liquid cry of woe and warning. A possum trotted by, an ungainly ghost. The branches overhead dipped and released a spray of water as some night bird settled in. Invisible hands, tangible and warm, settled over Eleanor's fingers where they rested on Justin's chest. A shadow swirled around her, not quite holding a shape, faceless, incorporeal, but crackling with energy. Eleanor sucked in her breath, awe and wonder momentarily striking her motionless. She felt as if she had been drawn into a bear's cave or a wolf's lair, some place hidden, safe, and sheltered. She lifted her hands, but Justin still breathed. The Black Mother's palms still lay pressed against his chest. Shakily, she came to her feet, almost stumbling from weariness and a sense of marvel. "You will keep him safe, won't you?" she whispered, almost stammering the words. "No one will see him. No one will come upon him and do him harm. I will be back by dawn if I can. You will not leave him alone for a minute, will you? Someone will guard him this whole time." There was no answer, but a slow prickle of danger spider-walked down Eleanor's spine. Slowly, carefully, she turned to scan the road behind her. For a moment, even her night vision could make out nothing on the path or under the trees. But then she saw it, pacing forward with a slow, menacing step. A Raelynx. The goddess's own creature, seldom found anywhere outside the borders of the Lyrith Mountains. Even in the darkness, Eleanor could make out its red fur, its tufted ears, its grace and power and utter ferocity. It stalked right by her and settled next to Justin in the mud, lending its own body heat to the fallen man, guarding Justin from anyone who might happen upon him in the night. It took an effort of will for Eleanor to swallow. "Thank you, Mother," she whispered. "I will be back by morning." She bent to strip a cloak from one of the fallen soldiers and wrap it around her shoulders. She was suddenly cold, she who never noticed the chill, and she felt herself shaking from the combined effects of fear and rage and magic. She randomly chose one of the soldier's horses, a young bay mare that looked both sturdy and swift, and led the rest of them deeper into the forest, looping their reins over low-hanging branches. No need to ask again. She was sure the Dark Watcher would make sure no passers-by happened to catch a glimpse of these animals. She did not have the strength to pull the bodies from the road, but somehow she trusted the goddess to handle this detail as well. She would send her buzzards and vultures to pick the bodies clean by daybreak, or she would disguise them with an opaque sorcery. Eleanor would trust her to take care of it all. "Keep him safe," she whispered one last time, then threw herself into the saddle and kicked the horse forward into a headlong canter. "Mother, I beg you, keep him alive." She heard, or maybe she only thought she heard, a whispered promise in return. "Daughter, I will." Chapter 29 Eleanor raced through the night, as if outrunning the end of the world, as if a great chasm was opening behind her, splitting the earth the instant her horse's hooves lifted from the ground. She had picked her mount well, or else the goddess had given her this one last gift and lent the bay mare speed and strength to outdistance the dawn. They flew through the forest, stumbling over no fallen logs, tripping in no muddy sinkholes. When there were hazards, Eleanor could see clearly enough to guide the horse past them, but mostly their way was smooth. Finally, out of the dark, tangled overgrowth of woodland and onto the flatter, easier open road, Eleanor crouched low over the horse's neck, urging her on to greater speed, murmuring encouragement, offering praise. The horse never faltered and never broke stride. The miles passed, blurred by tears and motion. The stars, usually so quick to dance through their rotations, crept slowly across the night sky, as if dragging their sparkling feet, holding back the march of dawn. The waning moon watched her from its half-closed eye as if afraid of what it might see below. She had been running for more than 2 hours when Eleanor finally saw Neft taking shape on the horizon. A few dark buildings bulked up against the night sky. Torches and lamplight offered a fitful, wavering illumination. Every shape grew clearer as she pounded closer. She could start to identify the few places she knew on the outskirts of town. A tavern, two ramshackle houses, a freighting office, a shop. It might not have been as late as she had thought, certainly not midnight yet. A number of pedestrians were still abroad, as well as a few other travelers on horseback. Up ahead of her, a man was slowly guiding a wagon and team toward the stables on the edge of town. She clattered past all of them, slowing the horse only slightly and earning a couple of surprised glances. Where would the magistrate Faber be at this hour? Justin had told her he frequented the tap rooms, but she had no idea how many of those could be found in Neft. Still, she would go to the first one she could find and start asking for him. Eventually, someone would be able to tell her where he was. There was no one else she could trust. There was no one else in Neft she knew, except Paulina Nocklin, who lived in the Gieseltess house with a woman who was kin to the Lestra. No hope there. It must be Faber. She must be able to find him. She envisioned a long, panicked night of running from tavern to tavern, begging strangers for aid, rousing all kinds of suspicion that might harm Justin in the long run. But the Black Mother was still watching out for her. Or maybe, just maybe, the Silver Lady felt twinges of remorse and sympathy. Someone's divine hand tugged on Eleanor's shoulder just as she turned the mare down a short street lined with a collection of unkempt buildings. Someone convinced her to fling herself from the saddle in front of the second building and push her way through the swinging door into a warm, well-lit, spicy-smelling room. It was such a contrast to the cold and dark of her journey that, for a moment, Eleanor stood frozen at the threshold, unsure of what to do next, whom to approach, what to say. More than a few people had looked up at her entrance and now surveyed her with interest. She realized she must look a fantastic sight, her hair wild, her hands bloody, her muddy white robes only partially covered by a large dirty cloak that she had clearly borrowed or stolen. If she had ever hoped to accomplish this part of the mission unobserved, she had just lost her last chance. A medium-sized, somewhat rumpled man was crossing the room on his way from the bar to a table in the back. He glanced at Eleanor, set down a pitcher of beer, and came up to her with a quizzical smile. "You look like someone who's run into a whole bunch of different kinds of trouble," he said, and his voice was rumbling and kind. "You trying to find someone? Or something?"
"I need the magistrate," Eleanor said, trying to sound calm. He didn't look entirely surprised.
"I'm Faber," he said.
Oh, surely that was the work of the Pale Mother. She delighted in unexpected gifts.
"I have to talk to you. It's urgent," Eleanor said. "Can we step outside?"
Not hesitating, he nodded and escorted her out the door. Eleanor knew everyone in the tavern was watching by now, but at least no one would be able to overhear their conversation. As soon as the door swung shut, she said baldly,
"Justin's been hurt. I need someone to help me bring him to safety. In secret," she added.
Faber's face showed instant concern.
"Hurt? How? Where is he?"
She watched his face for any faint change in expression, hoping he could be trusted as much as Justin believed.
"He's on the road leading out of the forest that surrounds the Luminan Convent," she said slowly. "Five guards attacked him this afternoon and almost killed him, but he's still alive."
Now Faber looked astonished.
"Five guards? And he's the one who's not dead?"
She brushed that aside as of no importance.
"There was another man with him, a freighter from town. He may have accounted for one or two."
"No," said Faber positively. "I know Jenkins, and he's never held a sword in his life." "Justin fought off five men? Killed them all? Who is that boy?"
"I don't know," she said, her voice growing a little ragged, "but he'll be a dead one soon if we don't go after him now."
Faber's lined face softened as he looked at her.
"Young lady, if he was close to death when you left him, there's no chance he's still alive now."
"Yes, he is," she said fiercely. "I swear to you, I know for certain, he will survive till dawn. But after that, if you don't help me, he will die. Or more soldiers from the convent will find him. Surely they'll come looking by daybreak. Please, please help me bring him to safety."
He nodded.
"I've got a cart small enough to fit down that forest road behind a tandem team, but we'll need guards of our own in case we run into trouble."
"No," she said. "I don't want... If anyone knows where Justin is, more soldiers will come for him. He won't be safe."
"We can trust these guards," Faber said. "They're my sons. Come on."
He turned from the tavern and began striding purposefully down the street. Eleanor snatched up the reins of her horse and followed. She was flooded with relief. She had secured aid. She was no longer alone in this desperate misadventure. But at the same time, her body was strung with tension. They were still so far away from Justin, and the minutes were skipping by so rapidly. They had to leave now. They should have been on the road 10 minutes ago. How could they spare time to harness horses and gather up reinforcements? It was as if Faber could read her thoughts.
"It won't take long," he said in a soothing voice. 15 minutes, maybe 20, you'll see. We'll be back on the road. Now, when we get to my house, I want you to go in while I'm fetching the cart. I want you to eat something. My wife will still be awake. She'll feed you. I want you to clean up your face, maybe change your clothes. Marnie will find you something to wear.
You've had a long night, and it's going to get longer. Don't be stupid. Take care of yourself if you're going to take care of that young man. Finally, they arrived at Faber's house, a rambling two-story building that radiated the same comfort and strength that Faber himself did. More quickly than Eleanor really expected, he had called for his sons, sent them out to hitch the wagon, given Marnie a brief synopsis of the night's challenge, and gone off to get his own overcoat. Marnie, a large, clear-eyed, capable-looking woman, handed Eleanor a plate of food and disappeared to rummage through her closets. In just about the time Faber had predicted, Eleanor had been fed and cleaned up, the wagon was ready, and his two sons waited outside the door, mounted on horseback.
"I figure you can ride in the wagon with me on the way out, since you'll probably be riding with Justin on the way back," Faber said, helping Eleanor onto the bench beside the driver's place.
The wagon was so narrow that they were sitting shoulder to shoulder.
"We put your horse in the barn. Don't imagine anyone will find it unless they go looking pretty hard. Ready, boys? Let's be on our way."
This half of the journey seemed to take forever. There was no way a cart, even pulled by a team, could make the same kind of time as a single rider. Eleanor felt her muscles cramp with apprehension. Her lip bled because she bit it so hard to keep from crying out for greater speed. She must trust the goddess. The Black Mother would not abandon Justin, not now. Look, it was still dark, only a short time past midnight. The goddess had promised to stay till dawn. Their pace slowed as they entered the forest, for even this small cart was a little too wide to navigate the twists and turns of the woodland trail. Eleanor thought she would scream from impatience as Faber carefully guided the team through a sharp angle in the road. She wanted to beg him to stop the cart, let her take one of the horses and ride on ahead. She would meet them at the place in the road where the bodies lay in a pile. But she knew they would never find that place if she was not with them. The goddess would conceal it from everyone except Eleanor herself. At last, a dip in the road, a turn into shadows, and they came upon the site of the battle. Six corpses still lay in the road, clear to Eleanor's eyes, although Faber's sons practically rode right over them.
"Stop! Stop! Here we are!"
Eleanor exclaimed, scrambling from the cart while it was still in motion. She could sense the confusion from Faber's sons, hear one of them say, "What? Here?" as he pulled back hard on the reins. She didn't pay attention. She lit out at a flat run for the patch of ground a few yards away where a fair-haired man lay motionless on the bloody soil. She practically collapsed at his side, her hands outstretched to touch him before she had even fully come to rest. Heart beating, breath warm at the corners of his mouth. Alive, alive. She heard the commotion around her as Faber drew his team to a halt and the three men tossed each other questions. "Where'd she go? I don't see her, do you? If that isn't the strangest thing. I can't see a damn thing on this road. It's like there's a mist or something. But that's not it. It's just purely impossible to see." They probably would be glad they couldn't see if they knew what was hiding under the Black Mother's cloak of darkness. The Raelynx. Lying against Justin's body across from where Eleanor knelt, now pushed himself to a seated position. He yawned, showing his splendid, sharp teeth, and gazed about him, as if wondering what other interesting sights this territory might hold. Then, so quickly that Eleanor did not see him move, he bunched his muscles and sprang away into the forest. She didn't even hear the slightest sounds from his passage. One night visitor remained behind. Eleanor could sense the presence of the Black Mother still crouched near Justin's head. She was nothing more than a coil of darkness, a suggestion of weight in the formless air.
"Thank you," Eleanor whispered. "Thank you. All I ask now is that you give me the strength to do the rest, to heal him, to make him whole. And lift your magic from this place now, for these others are here to help me. I cannot tell you what is in my heart. All I know is that I will love you forever."
The shadow grew denser for a moment, and Eleanor felt the distinct shape of a kiss pressed against her forehead. A pulse of fire surged through her. She felt her blood run with heat. Momentarily, she was blinded, even her preternatural vision failing. And then suddenly the darkness lifted, as if a sullen fog had evaporated in an instant. She heard one of Faber's sons gasp and one of them curse.
"There she is," Faber said. "And great holy goddess, there are the bodies. I didn't think it could be true."
"There are 6 dead men here," one of his sons exclaimed. "And you're saying this fellow killed 5 of them?"
"Doesn't seem possible," Faber said. "But I think it's so. Let's get him in the wagon, boys. Daybreak can't be more than a few hours away, and we need to be on the road quick as we can."
"I see horses back through the trees," one of the sons called as Faber came to his knees beside Eleanor. "Do we leave them behind?"
"No. Rope them together and we'll lead them into town," Faber said over his shoulder.
Then he turned his head and gazed down at Justin's face.
"And he's really still alive?" he asked, quietly enough that only Eleanor could hear. "You must possess a powerful bond with that silver lady of yours. I can't imagine anything but a goddess's touch keeping a man breathing when he's in a state like this.
No time to go into it all right now."
"The goddess has been good to me," was all Eleanor said. "Let's get him in the wagon and go."
That was a nightmare journey, out of the forest, down the endless road, back to the streets of Neft. Eleanor was aware of every slow, agonizing mile they traveled. She only vaguely paid attention to her companions as Faber's sons ranged before and behind the wagon, keeping an eye out for trouble in any form. Now and then Faber spoke to her from the front bench, but her answers were muffled and incomplete. All her attention was on Justin. All her energy was poured into him. She lay beside him in that cramped, jarring, rocking cart, one hand on his heart and her lips against his cheek, and willed him to stay alive. Dawn was uncurling over the horizon as they pulled wearily into Neft. The sky was actually light as Faber and his sons carried Justin into the house and up a wide set of stairs. Marnie had prepared a room for him, a soft bed, a roaring fire, a selection of clean bandages, and 3 basins full of water. As soon as the men had settled Justin into his bed, Marnie shooed them all out the door.
"Eleanor and I will clean him up now. You 3 go rest."
"Eleanor needs some rest herself, I'm thinking," Faber said.
Marnie cast Eleanor 1 quick appraising look.
"I expect Eleanor will want to spend a little more time getting our patient settled," she said. "Now you go on to your rooms."
She paused long enough to kiss her husband, and then shut the door.
"Let's get this young man taken care of," she said.
They worked together nearly an hour, cleaning and rebinding Justin's wounds, washing his face and hands, wiping away as much of the blood as they could. Marnie matter-of-factly stripped him naked and redressed him in loose clothes that probably belonged to one of her sons, handling him so gently he barely grunted with the pain. Eleanor couldn't help but notice all the old scars that crisscrossed Justin's chest and arms and legs. Some of them were from clean wounds that had probably been made by a sword and had obviously been well tended. Some were still red, ragged marks across his flesh that looked as if they had been acquired in a street fight and left to fester.
"There's quite a story to this boy's life," Marnie remarked, as she settled him back on the pillow. "Do you know it all?"
Eleanor shook her head slowly.
"Almost none of it."
"But he's worth something to you."
"I love him."
"Worth everything, then?"
Marnie hesitated. She was still perched on one side of the bed, but her hands were in her lap. She'd done what she could. Eleanor sat on the other side, patting Justin's face, his hands, the newly wrapped bandages, checking, just checking, to make sure everything was secure, that he was still breathing, that his heart was still beating.
I'll watch him for a few hours. There's a room right next door, and I've made up that bed, too. You get some sleep, and I'll take care of him."
Eleanor didn't even look up as she shook her head. "No, I'll stay with him."
"I thought you'd say that, but you've had a hard night already, and you must be at your very limit. I promise I won't leave him."